You're listening to a podcast from 702.
We're going to be shooting the breeze with two of my faves. Love them to bits. Hang out with me, Cizwe, and Loveland for the next hour. Chip in, be part of the conversation, or just be of a year. If you want to be of a year, you know, the world is divided into two categories of people. There are exhibitionists, like you, CBS, and then you have the silent voyeurs, those of you who never tweet, but you are actually spending as much time as the rest of us just with popcorn and watching what's going on. Let me introduce my guest, Cizwe Mpofu-Walsh. Love him to bits. He, of course, is an author, a scholar, a gentleman, and also a postdoctoral fellow at the Wits Institute for Social and Economic Research at Wits University, popularly known as WISER. Cizwe, how's it?
CBS, very well. Glad to be with you, and glad to be with this community of listeners for whom I have such a soft spot.
Yeah, and we have missed you. I realized when I reached out to you during the week ahead of today, you and I haven't been hanging out in ages. So here's a wonderful excuse for us to do so. Thanks so much for coming on. The other person I love dearly is social justice advocate, Loveland Wade with a silent N. How's it, Loveland?
Greetings. I'm very well, just cold. How's it going with you?
I am so cold, it's not even funny. What are you wearing? Have you got a blanket around you? Where in the house are you? Because we can't see you.
I literally stay in my room these days because the rest of the house is so cold. And I sit with the kettle and then I boil the kettle and then I drink hot water. So at least I'm staying hydrated.
And you, Cizwe, are you warm?
I'm ashamed to say that there are various layers being adorned at the moment, and I've now descended to the level of three pairs of socks.
It's a lot, as the young ones would say. You know, this hour we're going to be talking about what's in our minds. This is a shooting the breeze segment of the show that is so, so popular. And we do it every other month or so. We've had one recently when we had creatives on and it was amazing. Really, really, really was awesome. And I asked Cizwe and Loveland to come on this week. I want to start off by just reflecting on a question in my mind, and we can meander after that and see where. You know, when I did constitutional law, it's like yesterday when I wrote my con law paper. One of the things drummed into my head by my constitutional law lecturer is clearly a potential fiction, or at least a statement that needs to be problematized now with the wisdom of age. One of the first things we were told is 1994 was a radical break with the past, that what 1994 signaled, and therefore the adoption of the final version of the Constitution in 1996, is a never again approach to law and politics in this country. And instead of having an evolution towards deep liberal democratic roots, we opted in a revolutionary manner to have a radical break with the past. And now, you know, as a student who did subjects like legal theory and philosophy, but didn't do anthropology or sociology, I think to myself, yeah, I wish I had done social science subjects that are more deeply committed to empiricism and data than the subjects that I did choose. Because if you pay attention to the facts about the state-sponsored violence in our society, no one wants racists to listen to us when we talk about similarities between pre-94 and post-94, because there are profound differences. But we also can't glibly say that it was a radical break with the past. As you're listening to me, even just saying that and framing that, what comes up for the both of you? Let's start with you, Cizwe.
Well, thanks, Cizwe. It's a question that I've been thinking very deeply about, potentially brought on by the solitude of Corona. Mm. But I really do think that it's high time that we reappraised the 1994 moment. I think that the celebration of 1994 and the adulation that came with it has had a way of obscuring the realities that South Africa faces, and with the benefit of hindsight, I think it's time that we really started to inquire into exactly what was achieved and exactly what wasn't achieved, and trying to kind of break away from the mythology of that moment, which runs so deep in the public psyche, and it's so important to all of us personally. And while we do that, I think it's important that we avoid tropes, like you suggest. I think it's important that we actually think deeply about what was really significant. And I think that the constitutional moment, the deracialization of the electorate, the delegislation of apartheid were significant. Mm. But I think there's a difference between saying that the moment of 1994 was significant and saying that it was sufficient. And I think that's the mistake that we've made, is we assume that the constitutional moment will by necessity create a more just and a more equal, even some would venture to say a decolonized society. And I think that assumption is when we really need to probe that, because the structures of our society seem to be at odds with the aspiration of our society. And I think we really need to probe why that is in this moment.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's right. I mean, I have got nothing to add to that. Loveland, do you agree with Caesar?
For the most part, I do. You know, I was thinking about how do we define whether something was radical or not.
Yeah.
So I do think that part of what we haven't figured out is the test for how we evaluate whether something was, as Caesar said, sufficient or significant. How do we assess what was radical, right? So if you sort of Google quickly and look for a definition around what radical means, you will often come across something that speaks to, you know, affecting the fundamental nature of something, or like a complete, total change, right? And I think that depending on where you are in the political spectrum, depending on where you were in 94 may or may not have felt radical, right? So when you listen to a lot of our elders talking about that time, given the context of the world they had grown up in, just having the vote felt radical, right? Just having political, having a political voice felt radical. It so happens that 20 years down the line, 25 years down the line, we're now interrogating whether that was enough, and whether that was enough to really deliver on the idea of freedom that people had. So in that context, freedom seemed to be so strongly tied to having a vote. And now we realize that, well, you can't eat freedom, right? So now we're, you know, engaging, not now as in today, but I think the conversation that's emerged over the last 10 years has been, well, we've got to look beyond political freedom. We've got to look at economics. We've got to look at gender. We've got to look at race and you know, what the broader conception of justice is. So I think that's the work we need to do as a society, is to define for ourselves what radical is. I'm also not naive enough to completely write off 94, right? I think that it's very easy for, at least for me, who I wasn't there, you know, I was just a thought around the time. So it's easy for me to sort of level criticism at that time. But I do think it's important for us to engage in the context of who was doing the negotiation, who was present at those conversations, and did they have the political imagination and the social
imagination? But I think, Loveland, what we can do, right? I mean, let's be nerdish about it. There's the question of, was it a radical break normatively? That's the kind of language I like as a philosophy student. Caesar speaks about the word aspirationally. And then there's the hindsight question. Both of those questions are, I think, important discourse work that needs to be done, right? It was a radical break normatively, deracializing voting rights, for example, deracializing legislation. That's critically important. And the reason why all of us, my generation of undergrad law students, were enamored by constitutional law at the time is because we had progressive law teachers telling us about the normative vision of a constitution and how it sets up an ideal for a better society than the one that we are trying to leave behind. In that sense, there was radicalism. There was radical jurisprudential break with a wicked legal system. In the same breath, we can say, now we need to do the auditing. Let's audit South Africa since 1994. As a matter of fact, did it play out as per the vision? And when I think of Marikana, when I think of Collins Khosa, then the example after example after example stack up to suggest that is not the case. And then I'm left discombobulated.
Yes, no, I agree with you. And I think that's the conversation I'm interested in. I'm interested in us talking about this audit, right?
Yeah.
Because we can say maybe legally, yes, we did do some radical work. Socially, did we? You know, was our idea of reconciliation really reconciliation? Was it just, you know, a slap on the wrist for something much more heinous? That's the conversation we need to have. And I'm interested in going there because I think if we only focus on, you know, the political changes or the you know, legal constitutional changes, anyways, we're selling ourselves out by doing that because we're not engaging in the hard, tough elements of this conversation, which is about, was there an apology given? In the event that an apology was given, what has restitution actually looked like? Are we ready to actually move past the, you know, cosmetic aspects of reconciliation and really engage in what justice looks like? All of those conversations, I think we're ready for. Those conversations are long overdue.
Well, let's speak into them right now. I think that's spot on, Lovelyn. Sizwe, what's wonderful about the word justice is that it's also horrible at the same time, is that it's so layered, like the number of socks you are wearing. Justice has got a legal meaning, but for those of us who are interested in the rest of the liberal arts and humanities, it is also imbued with moral and normative and political meaning and not just legal meaning. And my law friends always get annoyed with me when I try and drive a wedge between the application of the law and conversations about the legal system as a self-contained system that is important in society in terms of trying to regulate behavior between people that otherwise may try and, you know, not necessarily respect each other if it wasn't for the regulatory mechanism called the legal system. But justice is imbued with much more moral meaning and aspiration than just the business of putting in place a legal system. South Africa in 2020, is it a just society? And what does that mean in terms of what it is that we're trying to gauge for, Sizwe?
No, that's such a fascinating question. And I think it's one that you rightly point out is enmeshed with a lot of legal and constitutional questions. And of course, this word justice, as you say, kind of straddles both the legal sphere but also the political sphere. In short, I think not. And I think this maybe goes back to one of the things you spoke about, which I think we perhaps need to reappraise, to the extent that I think that the Constitution does represent great progress, but I'm not sure whether it represents normative radical change. I think it represents a kind of intermediate position between the old society and perhaps a society that might be even more just and even more equal, because of the way that it was born out of a very particular compromise. And so in terms of this question of justice and the Constitution, I think it's fascinating. I actually looked at this recently, how many times the Constitution mentions the word justice. And it's actually not that much. It talks a lot about equality. It talks a lot about dignity. But the only times it really mentions justice, apart from a brief mention in the preamble, is about the administration of justice and about justice in a narrow sense. And I think that really reveals a lot about the tensions in our society at the moment. We've in many ways traded justice, and this is part of the compromise. We've traded justice in the broad sense for stability. We've traded justice for a legal equality. But in trading justice, we've kind of left this residual bubbling tension, which is also at the foundation of our society, but is often less spoken. So I don't think we're a particularly just society. And I think the problem is that we aspire to be an equal society, but beyond our aspirations and into the structures in our everyday relations, in contracts between individuals and companies, in the private sphere, in private enclaves where people live and work, you know, behind boom gates and security guards. In those places, I don't think the aspirations, sometimes narrow as they are, really permeate as fully as we predicted they might.
Absolutely. 22 minutes after 10, if you've just tuned in, we are shooting the breeze with Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh, postdoctoral fellow at WISE at Wits University and social justice advocate, Lovelyn Wade. We've kicked it off with a really, really beautiful, difficult, important South African question. Was 1994 a radical break with the past, and that immediately has set us on a path of complexity and intrigue? Do you agree, disagree with anything you've heard? If you're just enjoying the conversation, you can just listen in and hang out with us remotely. Otherwise, jump in. 011-883-0702.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
On 702.
Lavelle and I desperately want to stay inside this dialectic between the three of us because it is just so beautiful. But at the same time, I want to move to other things. Given that we mates, what shall we do? Shall we continue chatting about this one? Or do you want to tell me what else you've been bothered by recently?
I mean, I think I was going to pull the justice conversation into our responses to Corona, because I think that's a perfect example to talk about how we've been lying a lot about how coronavirus can infect us all, but it doesn't affect us all the same way. And I think that part of what has been exposed by the lockdown and the country's response to the pandemic is that we don't live in a just society. We don't live in a society that centers justice. So the solutions and the regulations that government has drawn up have been solving for generally a middle class person living in a suburb with very little interest in the experiences of people just 3, 4, 5 kilometers down the road, you know, who are in a township where certain social distancing measures aren't possible, you know, where certain freedoms aren't even part of the imagination. So for me, I'm interested in actually digging deeper into just a moment like this, which is a global problem. It does, you know, affect all of us, but the differentials in how we're experiencing this moment speaks to the lack of justice in our society. And I think we are often, there's a word that I'm looking for, I think we're often hoodwinked by ideas about equality and treat everyone the same because it's comfortable. But when you start talking about things like equity and fairness and justice, it does carry a cost. And it carries the cost of people who do have privilege in this country actually being willing to lay that down or raise their voices in order to make sure that we're treating people the way they need to be treated because of where they're placed in the social hierarchy.
This is why I love you so much, Lavelle. I was so annoyed with Minister Jackson Mthembu's when a foreign correspondent had asked him about the demographics of those who are affected. And he was trying to have a post-racial moment by suggesting that this virus doesn't care about your race. Maybe it's different if you're in America or in the UK. And he missed the point. And the point is precisely that, of course, the virus itself is incredibly democratic in terms of who it will affect. It's not going to not enter your body if your name is Karen. But depending on your social positionality, the odds of how you will be affected, whether you'll be affected, do depend on racialized and classed elements that reveal the deep fissures in our society. I mean, the reality is that it is going to be a certain demographic of South Africans that will be the ones who carry the disease burden of the country more than others, who are therefore more likely to end up on a respirator and more likely to fight for their lives. And so this idea of like, one upside to 2020 is that, yes, it's a pandemic, but for once we can put race and class aside. As far as I'm concerned, it's absolute balderdash. I'm not sure whether you agree, Sizwe, with Lavelle and what I'm tagging on there. But researchers in the UK and the USA, they have been far quicker than we have done here, both in the academy and also journalistically, to understand which groups are, as a result of structural injustices, disproportionately affected. We are pretending that, as sad as the pandemic is, that we should also use it as a kumbaya moment.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And it's been, in some ways, so frustrating to watch how this whole furore over regulations has played out. And I think it really is emblematic of so many of these absences of justice in our society. So I think one of the things that's been so frustrating for me, which relates to what you were saying, is that race and gender and class are so palpably, obviously layered over our society, but then so absent from the public debate often. So we keep having these conversations without often really mentioning them. And it's almost as if now, over 25 years later, if you mention race, you know, people roll their eyes and they kind of think they know what you're going to say before you say it.
Yes.
And we've kind of stopped really leveling the critique as strongly as we need to. And it just appeared to me, especially in that period when, you know, people were pretending to be, you know, anti-apartheid activists because they wanted to surf, that, you know, back to this question of justice and democracy. Democracy is premised on the notion that each voice weighs the same. But I often get the feeling in our society that the concerns, often of white South Africans, but generally South Africans located to privilege, their irritations are weighed similar to the lives of those who don't get those platforms. So that in order to assuage the irritations and the feelings of discomfort, we've now potentially in some ways imperiled the actual lives of the people who have to travel from townships to serve the people who feel discomfort and irritation by the lockdown. And I think there are other arguments to be made about why certain regulations should be deregulated, but we should interrogate this idea that at the end of the day, opening the economy, quote unquote, means that most of the people who are privileged will be able to stay at home. And in fact, the people who have to get the economy going and working will have to travel and serve those people. And our society is still in many ways economically structured in that way.
100%. John, joining the conversation, what's on your mind?
Good morning. I'd like to just pose the following question. Your panel and yourself are philosophizing about the history of the country, racism, classism, but I don't hear one solution. Give me a solution. You know, for example, I have a solution. Myself and a group of businessmen have got together and make about 300 liters of soup once a week, and we distribute it to the hungry and the needy. That is a solution. I'd like you to, just for once, give us a solution. We have got to do the following to get rid of the remnants of apartheid, as an example, the classism, as an example.
John,
I don't hear solutions.
Okay, John, number one, breathe for me. Number two, listen to Tara Penny, and then go make a pot of wonderful chamomile tea. And on the other side of news headlines, I'm going to give you a full response.
No, live, transform. This is 702. This is 702. For the curious.
28 minutes before 11 o'clock, we're shooting the breeze, hanging out with Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh, postdoctoral fellow at Wiser, off the back of a successful defense of his doctoral thesis in international relations at Oxford University, and excellent social justice advocate Lovelyn Wade, who's been doing really beautiful work helping institutions like schools, for example, to think about their organizational culture and ethos. And with her toolkit, she is someone you definitely want to hire to try and transform your workplace, your institution that you are a leadership part of, to really take seriously the justice-centered approach towards how we live our lives, including inside the institutions that we spend a lot of hours in as part of the world of work. And that's why I've got the both of them on today. Lovelyn and Sizwe, each one of us would have a response to John. I'm going to abuse the fact that it's my show and have the first bite of the cherry.
I wanted to go first. I was so ready for John.
Lovelyn, go first.
Okay, thanks. So just before I answer the question, I want to thank John for his response to what his idea of a solution is, right? So the first thing is just, I think we mustn't underestimate the importance of thinking through problems. Because I think it's easy to sort of criticize people who do spend time philosophizing, and there is a danger, obviously, pontificating about things. But I think it's important to think through a problem thoroughly so you can actually solve it properly. Number two, John's example of a solution, and I'm really not saying this to trash anybody who's doing that kind of feeding schemes, looking after the needy, but charity is not a replacement for justice, right? We wouldn't need to be doing charity work if we lived in a just society. And that brings me to what I think our solutions can be. The first thing is that we know that South Africa is an extremely unequal society, both on income and all other sort of dimensions of wealth, property, etc. So I really think it's important for us to implement something along the lines of a universal basic income, which I think could easily be funded through a wealth tax in this country, right? So most executives and CEOs in this country are earning obscene salaries, often 50 to 100 times more than what the lowest paid worker in the company earns, right? So I think just starting with something like a wealth tax already helps us to renegotiate that gap between the haves and the have-nots. And I think what we need to remember is that when you're paying people at the bottom of the economic pyramid, when you're paying them more, that money isn't leaving the country. So when you give tax benefits to people at the top of the economic pyramid, it's normally spent on luxury items. When you're giving extra money to people at the bottom of the economic pyramid, it stays within their communities, it stays within our economy. The second thing that I think is a viable solution is doing the work of education in our schools, right? So when we're talking about things like racial literacy education, critical diversity literacy education, it's so important because we forget the powerful role that apartheid and colonialism had on the psyche of people in this country. So in my opinion, apartheid and colonialism was just as damaging to the psyche of white people as it was damaging to the psyche of colored and black and Indian South Africans. The consequences of that damage are not the same, but it was damaging nonetheless. And if we don't do the work of fixing our minds, what we believe about ourselves and what we believe about each other, which has to start at a school level, then we might as well give up on the project that is South Africa. And then the third thing that I would do, Eusebius, is actually implement affordable housing, right? So every single, I would actually require that every single complex, estate, all these luxury sort of accommodations in our country reserve X amount of units for affordable housing for people of a lower income, which is subsidized by the rentals of the properties in that area. Those are three solutions, John. I have lots more, but I'll give others a chance.
Oh, that's absolutely gorgeous. And if you call in the next 10 minutes, she'll give you a discount for the other solutions. Seizwe?
You know, I couldn't agree more with what Lovelyn has said, and I think she's put it very well. But I would also just want to reinforce this idea and really want to push back against this constant refrain that need solutions. You know, there's that famous Lincoln quote which goes something along the lines of, you know, if you're wanting to chop down a tree, you know, do you hack away at the tree or sharpen the axe? And in 2017, I wrote a book, actually, John, which you might want to refer to, which is literally chock full of solutions, everything from land to education to various other topics. But I don't think that's where we have a problem right now. Every political party has multiple solutions. Every institution, NGO, government department, analyst, columnist has solutions. We are, you know, up to our eyeballs in solutions. If you don't see them or read them, it's probably a failure on your part because they're prevalent and they're widespread. But I don't think we've analyzed what the problem is. And until we do that and until we realize how long that takes, you know, so part of this work that I'm doing to try and understand the remnants of apartheid, as John put it, is that it takes a long time to identify the real problem. The struggle against apartheid, for example, didn't just spring up out of nowhere. It actually took a generation to identify the problem. And only once the problem was properly identified, then, you know, proper ways of maneuvering around it were foreseen. And I don't think we've really thought through what are the remnants of apartheid. Because if we start to trace the way that apartheid has survived in the private sphere, which is a very complex exercise, then I think we can get to solutions that aren't just a question of hacking away at the tree with a blunt object, but actually would start to change the structure of our society. So I'm far more interested right now not in short-term solutions and in band-aids and quick fixes, but in really investing time in trying to understand why our society is so structurally unbudgeable, no matter what solution we try.
100%. Oh, man, I love the two of you so, so, so much. What I wanted to say is I've always had a suspicion of people who are obsessed with the solution space because you do not want to do the work, John, of sitting with and through your discomfort. I don't only want to live in an anti-racist South Africa and in a just South Africa. In the first instance, I want you to feel the pain of my experience of already having experienced injustice. And when you have your checkbook ready, it is an attempt to not sit through a conversation of stories of what people have experienced and how they've been impacted. You are so, so keen to talk solutions. And you've got to ask yourself, why is that? Is it because you are a pragmatist and therefore more useful instrumentally than Sizwe, Eusebius and Loveland? Or is it actually because you want to use your checkbook to get out of a difficult emotional conversation about impact? Of course I've got solutions. Of course Sizwe has solutions. And of course Loveland has solutions. And if, like you, we had the white privilege of accessing networks with huge capital, we'd be able feasibly to get on with implementing our solutions even more quickly than we are able to in the absence of those networks that you have. But the reason why sitting through this conversation, even if we don't talk solutions for the next week, is important, is that you need to understand that in order to fully grow, that you need to be comfortable to sit and devote time to the space between listening to the impact of injustice and only thereafter talking about what the solution space should look like. And I am deeply suspicious of people who say to me, what are your solutions? The quivering in your voice before we went to news is revealing, because what it reveals is a fundamental discomfort listening to three black South Africans talking about the impact of the past. You cannot bypass psychology with a checkbook.
On 702.
So, yeah, I've just got so many beautiful people on my show today that I love to bits. So, Rashni, you know how much I love you.
I love you too, you see.
I love you, you more.
I am loving this conversation. You know, we haven't heard from Caesar for a while, and it's great to have him back, even on Twitter. I just want to say, and Loveland, if Loveland opens a political party, I will vote for her and campaign for her, because everything she says,
me too,
that's what I believe, and I just love her. I just want to say,
I totally, totally agree with you that on Sarashni.
Oh my God, I just love her. There's a thing, and I've seen it even in my own community. And John triggered it for me, and that's why I called. There's a thing, even among very good Christians, among very good, relatively good people, we must go out there and help the poor. You know, the poor black people out there. But that is not empowering of black people. I think we need to be more humble. We need to listen to black people when they give you solutions. And sometimes you need to stand at the back and give black people a voice and empower them, even to find their own solutions. Why do you assume that you have all the solutions for them and that by feeding poor people, you are doing something? You're not doing something systemic and fundamental to change the society. And I think people like Loveland, her voice should be raised. I want to see her more in all media. And thank you for having her on.
Listen, if it was up to me and I had deep pockets, I would run my own news channel or radio station, and Loveland and Sizwe would be the first two people I would convince to come on.
That would be amazing. You should try something.
Yeah, but for that, we need some of that capital that Abo 1652 have. Yeah. So, John, give me that money so that we can move from charity to having our own actual media products.
There's a solution.
There's a solution right there.
That would be huge.
But thank you, Sarashni, and I love you to bits, but you know, Sizwe and Loveland, you guys are nicer than me. You go into the solution space beautifully, and I agree with everything you've said. And there's no deep disagreement between us, not even shallow disagreement on this one. But I really think it is so important that we call people out on not wanting to sit through stories. The single most important communicative benefit of radio, and I've told you this, Sizwe, many times when you and I chatted about radio as a medium, when you were standing in for me the first time. You know, when you do academic work like you've done and I've done, debating, you get told that stories don't matter. But stories lie at the heart of the human experience. And it's so fascinating to me who gets uncomfortable with stories that they hear. And that's why, although Loveland generously enumerates the solutions, I also think we in turn should have our Dr. Phil moment and be honest about what is going on when people want to hastily talk about solutions.
You know, I think it's, well, firstly, Loveland, can I please apply for deputy leader? I don't know if there's a, if it's an open democratic process or something in my application. and then John can be the secretary general.
The treasurer general.
I think that's so right, and we really need to reflect on the affect and the feeling of what it's like to be in the society, as opposed to just what's the economic data and what's happening in formal politics. What does it feel like to be in South Africa right now?
Yeah.
And I think part of what is so frustrating about John's comment is that there seems to be a desire on the part of white South Africans often to try to exonerate themselves through charity.
Mm.
So charity becomes not as much about giving to others as about exculpating guilt.
Yeah.
And it's okay that guilt is there. It's natural that guilt is there.
Mm.
But if we don't engage it and question it, and if we don't actually, if we stop this defensiveness, and saying speaking about race is not a solution, if we disentangle the defensiveness and ask why that defensive impulse is there in the first place, I think we actually end up having a much more productive conversation than
you should
do this solution and you should do that solution.
Yeah.
And so often I think that charity is just a guise for the erasure of or the false and mistaken erasure of guilt.
Mm, that is such a beautiful point. I love analogies flipping between class, gender, and race, because I think they are morally equivalent, even if the particularities play out differently, Loveland. And for me, I would put John's point differently if race is too triggering. Yesterday, me and Abel ran a documentary on the show on menstruation. Now, I cannot rush to ask, okay, how many menstrual cups do you want me to buy? Because it's too much for me to listen to women talking about secretly what the pain of menstruation is doing to you. You're unemployed. I had one woman who called us, and I literally was on the brink of tears. But of course, I shouldn't be commended for my tears. These are everyday reality for women across the globe, and us men choose to not understand. And it's the same thing. I challenged my male listeners to sit through that documentary yesterday because the stories are important. You can't 5 minutes into that conversation want to call in and say, can we move on to the literature corner? I've got R1 million here, man. I've got the solution already. Because you need to understand exactly what centuries of patriarchy continues to do to women. And that's important, important work. And the solutionist, as someone is putting so beautifully on Twitter, this is one of my favorite tweets during this hour from Lucky Luke, who says, damned solutionists are the ones who are responsible for all the problems around here.
Sure. One of the things that has been so helpful for me in my own journey, just around thinking about what's happening in the world, is this fundamental principle of logic, which is that two things can be true at the same time. And I think part of the huge gap in our education, and I'm really being dead serious about this, I think one of the huge gaps in our primary and secondary school education in this country is that we don't teach people how to think, and we don't teach people how to engage critically. And so I know we're picking on John in this conversation, but I think John is really just representative of a lot of people with whom I'm sure all of us have sat in these types of conversations. And it's a sense of, if we offer solutions, then we can solve the problems and we can keep things moving, right? And it is possible that we need to sit through the stories so that we can actually come to proper solutions.
Absolutely.
It is possible that we can offer great solutions that are well-funded and also actually misdiagnose the problem entirely.
Absolutely.
So for me, one of the things I'm really, you know, interested in, and this is part of the work that I do, is helping people who occupy positions of privilege. And please hear me, privilege is not limited to race, right? Mm. In South Africa, it is very much mediated by race.
Yeah.
But there's privilege across all social identifiers, race, gender, class, religion, sexuality, disability, you name it, right?
Mm.
So what I help people do is actually flex the muscles that they're not used to flexing when it comes to engaging in these conversations that require a practice of being comfortable with discomfort, right? If your only ability to engage in solutions allows you to reenact your privilege, that's not helpful.
Absolutely.
Because if the only way that you can imagine a solution is one that allows you to just, you know, throw your privilege at something, then that doesn't help us get where we need to go.
Absolutely.
What we want is a society where nobody's identity, which is a function of just random biology or just luck of the draw, nobody's identity should be a privilege. Do you understand?
I totally
do. What
we
want to get to is a society where my gender, which I don't have a choice over, or the way that society views my gender, the way that society views who I choose to love, the way that society views the color of my skin, that those things that I don't have authority over should never constitute an unfair benefit for me. That's the work that
absolutely.
We need to do.
I'm told we need to go shopping. I don't know whose money we're going to go use when we go shopping. We've got two choices. We can either use John's money if he wants to sponsor it, or sees we're being in the nomenclature of race being biracial. Maybe Mom Terry, white part. Terry, are you going to be responsible for the shopping? Let's see what's on the menu for shopping.
CBS MacIsaac. CBS MacIsaac. On 702.
Man, I want another 2 hours, right? On radio so you can yell conversations. Obviously being friends with them as well. I know I can have extra time with them off air. We're going to have to make sure we bring them back at least once in the next couple of weeks. Bangani, very quickly, what's on your mind?
Morning, how are you?
What's on your mind, Bangani? The clock is ticking.
What's on my mind is, if I can ask that lady that you're sitting with that says can help, can she allow a scavenger to sit and to be at a gate picking up from dust and then give her something?
I'm not sure I understand. Just say that again, if there's wind or something there in the background.
All right. I'm simply saying the lady that you're sitting with and talking of giving what things, helping, can she allow a scavenger where she stays in something or open her window to give her lunchbox to a scavenger at the robot or anywhere?
Why are you asking that question? We don't like rhetorical questions on the show. What is the point you want to make?
Okay. What I'm trying to bring home is, whichever company that you work for, you want to be empowered as well.
Yes.
We have NPOs. We give directors our NPO, give them our plans, but they steal them here.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
Right? When they steal our ideas, you see their children doing it. Oh, you're going to use me with my ideas.
I hear what you're saying, Bongani. Maybe you got your conversations cross-purposes. In pretentious Latin, we call that a non sequitur. Final thoughts, 30 seconds each from you. Sizwe, how are you feeling? What's in your mind at this point? It's been a nice, complex conversation.
It has been. I think more of the same is necessary. I think we've somehow got lost over the last 25 years in looking for short-term solutions and failing to return to the important tradition of really diagnosing the problem. And I think thinking about apartheid, thinking about how it persists and survives against this constitutional order and the tensions between the two are what we're called to do right now.
I totally agree with you. Loveland?
Hey, guys, we can all do better, man. We are tired. We are actually really tired. Also, now Bongani's call completely caught me off guard. No, but I think, look, practically speaking, guys, charity is not a replacement for justice. All of us have work to do in terms of learning to flex the muscles of discomfort.
that will allow us to do better when it comes to conversations about justice. And I think at the end of this process, none of us come out scot-free, you know? When you do the work of deep introspection,
yeah.
you find that all of us are implicated in systems that oppress each other.
Absolutely.
And when we look at those intersections, that's where we can start to do meaningful work.
Beautiful stuff. Lavlin, thank you for your brain, your commitment to social justice. Thank you for the work you do with institutions practically. I really do appreciate it. Lavlin Wade, thanks for coming on, social justice advocate, and she also does work in that space. And then Sizwe Mpofu-Walsh, who is absolutely brilliant, one of our country's bright young intellectuals, is a hip-hop artist, and having just finished his doctorate at Oxford, also a postdoctoral fellow at Wits University. Thank you, Sizwe.
Thanks so much, Eusebius. Thanks, Lavlin.